It's 7 o'clock. Coming up next, What's Going On with Bob Henley.
Brother, there's far too many of you dying.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and get here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me. So you can see, oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, what's going on?
Good morning, New York and New Jersey, as well as the great world beyond. This is the Chief Leader is Bob Henley at Stuck Nation, because we surely are. This is WBI's Drive Time News Magazine, What's Going On? And I'm your Monday morning back to work, back to school host. Our focus is always labor. And today, the entire show is dedicated to our badly broken healthcare system that's at the heart of so much of what ails us. It's just after 7 a.m., February 14th, Valentine's Day, 2022. Sunrise was at 6:51 a.m. Michael T. Haskins is our audio engineer, and Linda Perry is our executive producer. It's a chilly 21 degrees out in New York City, and with all that love in the air, we still won't break freezing, but the New York City retired civil servants marching to protest the city's Medicare Advantage plan won't have any snow or rain to contend with. Tomorrow, some mix of sun and clouds, but temperatures will get into the upper 40s. We cloud over Thursday, but get as high as the low 60s. Friday, there's a 40% chance of rain. The temperatures will range from the upper 20s to low 50s. Saturday and Sunday, we stay above freezing with no rain, with Sunday the best of the 2 days. And then we do it again. This morning, we'll hear from former New York City teacher and activist Gloria Brandman about the rally planned by New York City retired municipal workers to protest the city's plan to save hundreds of millions of dollars for the city a year by shifting to a new approach to how it covers hundreds of thousands of its retired workers. They're upset. We'll speak with Lottie Aaron, a senior fellow with the Urban Institute, about her latest research into how our nation's for-profit healthcare system is the world's most expensive, with poor results for the general population. We'll hear from Dr. Mark Levides with Physicians for our National Health Program on why so many physicians see Medicare for All, aka what we call East of the Hudson, the Newark Healthcare Act, as the prescription for a healthier country. And your calls, of course, at 212-209-2877. But first, the Pacifica Network News.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
So far, we've only seen escalation from Moscow. This is a pivotal moment. We're prepared for whatever should happen.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in Fiji over the weekend, but he described as troubling new Russian deployments near the border of Ukraine. President Joe Biden and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke by phone for an hour Sunday. And Vice President Kamala Harris heads to Germany this week for a security conference. The Munich visit marks her fifth foreign trip as vice president. Before her trip, Harris stopped in New Jersey Friday. She spoke about Newark's efforts to replace its lead water pipes.
It is a public health issue. It is an equity issue. It is an issue of education. It is an issue of whether we are willing to invest in our future in terms of investing in our communities.
Some civil rights leaders are pushing for faster administration action to replace lead pipes that hurt Black and Latino communities. A Canadian judge has granted police more authority to remove vaccine mandate protesters blocking the Ambassador Bridge to Detroit. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on the five-day blockade by truckers at the border.
The blockades are hurting small businesses and neighborhoods. At the border, they're impacting trade, supply chains, and manufacturing. The people these blockades are hurting are everyday families.
According to the New York Times, Rudy Giuliani is in active discussions with the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. The former New York mayor and lawyer for former President Donald Trump is under subpoena to testify about how closely Trump coordinated with the mob that attempted to overturn the election. A jury of nine is expected to resume deliberations today in former Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin's libel case against the Times. Palin sued the newspaper over an editorial linking her to a deadly 2011 shooting in Tucson that killed six and wounded then-member of Congress Gabby Giffords. Syracuse University law professor Roy Gutterman.
And Governor Palin is arguing that her reputation has been damaged by this false mistake that was published and corrected. The Times went really quickly and within 14 hours published a correction to set the record straight.
James Bennett, then the editorial page editor at the Times, has denied the newspaper intentionally tried to defame Palin. The Times corrected the article and says the error didn't harm Palin's reputation. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Thanks so much, Nadia. I'm joined on the line now by Gloria Bradman, no stranger to these airwaves, retired teacher, UFT activist, who's been very active in what can only be described as a significant civil servant retiring movement about folks who are really concerned about the direction of the city when it comes to their healthcare plan. Good morning, Gloria. Give us the coordinates for what we can expect today, and what do you folks hope to achieve?
Thank you. Good morning, Bob. Thanks so much for inviting me on your show again. I just wanted to take a few minutes to let your listeners know about an important event happening today at 12 noon by City Hall that's being sponsored by the Cross Union Retirees Organizing Committee, also known as CROC. Our purpose today is to tell Mayor Adams not to break our hearts, especially today on Valentine's Day. He is getting ready to change the traditional Medicare health insurance of over 250,000 municipal retirees, that is the health insurance that we were promised after years of working for the city. So now he wants to change it into a totally privatized Medicare Advantage plan. As a candidate, Eric Adams called this Medicare Advantage plan a bait and switch. But last week, he came out in support of this plan while still claiming that the city has had and will continue to have your best interests at heart. And I just also want to add very quickly that we just found out that the company that is running this plan, Anthem, is being sued by the federal government for stealing money from Medicare. And again, this is breaking news. It's pretty amazing. In any case, this fight is about our money and our health. And we don't believe Eric Adams. We like what we already have. No one asked us if we wanted to change it. We want to keep what we now have is traditional Medicare and a senior care Medigap.
One more question. I just want to ask you, where are the coordinates? Where do people need to go in the timing?
Okay, so, and we hope people come because they'll learn more about it. We need everyone to join this fight. You need to come out today, bring people, you know, tell the mayor not to approve it. It's going to be outside City Hall on Broadway by Murray Street at 12 noon, okay? It's going to be cold, dress warm, but our energy and our chanting and singing along with Dave Lippmann is going to keep us warm. So we need to let Mayor Adams know strongly, seriously, not to make this change happen.
Thanks so much, Gloria.
Okay,
we'll
thank
follow
you.
Up with you next week. Take care.
Okay, great. Okay, bye.
What about that? And now this from Mr. White.
What about this?
The words I have to say may well be simple, but they're true.
So that I can't wait to see what kind of crowd they get today outside down in Lower Manhattan. Of course, we're going to be keeping an eye on the final numbers for the number of civil servants that are expected to be laid off as a consequence of the vaccine mandate. Press reports were around 3,000. We'll see. I'm really pleased and honored to be joined on the line now by Lottie Aaron, a senior fellow at the Health Policy Center at the Urban Institute. For over 25 years, in 2013, she directed the groundbreaking 2013 study for the National Research Council and Institute of Medicine entitled, quote, U.S. Health in International Perspective, Shorter Lives, Poorer Health, which found a large and growing U.S. health disadvantage relative to other high-income countries. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
So I had to say, I read this and I was struck by the tragic prescience of it in terms of it was long before anybody heard about COVID or a pandemic. What did you and your colleagues find? And I must say your expertise of combining math and demographics, that really, I think, redeems STEM sciences. It can really be put to social justice. I had to give a tip of the hat to your disciplines. What did you find? What did your colleagues find back in 2013?
Well, that report, you know, I was the study director and I led a panel of national experts and scholars from a variety of different disciplines. But really, it was the first report to examine whether there was a health disadvantage in the United States, especially one that extended across the life course. And that was found across a wide variety of different types of illnesses as well as injuries. You know, sure enough, after digging deeply into the data, that report did end up showing very clearly, and a lot of the panel members themselves were quite stunned at what they were finding as we looked at the data together, that Americans are suffering from what the panel ended up calling this U.S. health disadvantage. And it had been developing over decades, since at least the 1980s. It spanned all ages, both sexes, all racial groups. I mean, the pervasiveness of this pattern was quite stunning. And as it turns out, you know, we have seen a continuation of that pattern since that report was released.
And did it manifest itself in terms of, give us a sense of how did it really impact families and lives, shorter life expectancy? What was it that popped out at you and your colleagues?
Well, you know, life expectancy is an interesting measure. If you really want to kind of have a very tight summary measure of mortality patterns at a given point in time, life expectancy is the measure you want. And And let's also understand that, you know, beyond life expectancy, like, so these early deaths that were documented in that report are preceded by, you know, many years and different types of illness and disability and, you know, all kinds of difficulties that Americans are experiencing in terms of, you know, early death and illness. So
you mean like acuity and chronic issues, right? Like acuity and chronic care issues.
Absolutely. And, you know, this, you know, and this is certainly relevant in the context of the global pandemic we're in right now. I mean, certainly a death is the end point for the person experiencing that death, but it's the beginning point for all of the family members, the loved ones, the neighbors, the employers, the community surrounding that person. And it really changes entire life trajectories with these early deaths. And, talking about early deaths in the context of the richest, you know, one of the richest countries on the planet. And the fact that, you know, almost every other high-income democracy is beating us out on health and wellness and survival across the board is pretty shocking.
I wanted to, it seems to me when you break it down, let me see if I've got this right. So we believe in this quote unquote real-time delivery. So it seems like what our healthcare is about is a for-profit system, is a preservation of capital. But, and so that means that people get care like at the last final moment, like they have such a hard time getting the resources aligned with the crisis. And we don't spend money on preventative healthcare because we run everything very much based on this idea of preservation of capital in the short term. Is this part of the mechanism here that leads to premature death when because we don't have a system that pays it forward in terms of investing in wellness? Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, there are all kinds of issues and challenges with how the U.S. healthcare system has been structured. And the 2013 report certainly documented, a real absence of, you know, relative to these other countries of good primary care, good preventive care, all of that. I mean, there's issues around access, around quality, around affordability of healthcare services. But equally importantly, healthcare is just one piece of what really makes for a healthy, successful, surviving life.
Right.
So it really goes into all of the different systems that matter to our conditions of life, whether it's around schooling and housing and safe neighborhood safety and just a very broad array of social and economic determinants of health and well-being. It's what many of us call the social determinants of health. And on those fronts, Americans are also really suffering in terms of poverty, in terms of insecurity, precarity. All of those are contributing to these early deaths as well.
And so that intersectionality, that this is really the red hot zone. So then, am I correct that I guess that 3 years prior to the pandemic, we saw American life, average life expectancy decline, correct?
Correct.
Right. And so I think the last time it happened was back like in the First World War. So it was an unusual, it's something that happens once a century. But I guess that then I saw this latest report you and your colleagues came out that looked at, I'm referring to the Ryan Masters study and Stephen Wolf study, about looking at those 2020 numbers in terms of mortality and COVID. What did you all find?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I've been doing some work with Steve Wolf, who's at Virginia Commonwealth University, and Ryan Masters, who's at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And, building on this 2013 report, we thought it would be really valuable to go look at the 2020 life expectancy data and really look at it alongside, again, these other high-income countries, what we call our peer countries. These are high-income democracies in Western Europe and in other parts of the world. And, we ended up documenting a very significant life expectancy decline in the United States, one that was 8.5 times greater than the average of our peer countries. So Americans lost 1.87 years of life that year in terms of life expectancy drops, whereas our peer countries experienced a drop of 0.22 years. And we looked at 16 peer countries, and 6 of those, they actually still experienced increases in life expectancy in 2020, which was very interesting.
Oh, I mean, I guess the thing that what we hear so often is we've got the best healthcare system in the world, the best healthcare system money can buy. And what you're paying for me just in terms of the data is something that is diametrically opposite to that. And I guess the thing is, having reported for the chief leader this granular unraveling over the last 2 years in terms of this public health disaster closing in on 1 million deaths, and then also the secondary impact of long COVID. I'm just wondering, if it would seem to me that what you and your colleagues are developing is the essential after-action report for any country that's interested in learning from this tragedy, that, you know, and I would imagine we could throw in there excess mortality. If you could talk about that, because that's another number I think that there's a lot of dislocation that happened because we were, from what you're telling me, the dashboard was blinking red crisis for years. So this was the precondition that set the stage for this mass death event. Am I overstating it?
You're not overstating it at all. I think those of us that have been tracking these, you know, these numbers and these conditions of life in this country over multiple decades, including that 2013 report, but also a number of reports and studies that came in the wake of that, were really concerned. And, you know, we see what's happening during COVID as in part a reflection of the very kind of weakened state the country was in going into this public health emergency. And again, you know, it's not just the stresses on our healthcare system, which I think we have all heard about in spades and is very real and important, but also about other aspects of life in this country and ways that, you know, Americans were really not in a place that where we could sustain this kind of, you know, this global pandemic. It is pretty shocking, and, you know, but really widening the lens to this multi-decade focus of what's been happening here is super important.
I wanted to throw out the line, call line, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877, if you want to get in on this conversation. So just to, because you do have this this kind of holistic approach to your analysis, I guess then a prescription would be talking about Build Back Better and the idea of, particularly for the idea of this workforce. Now, we know that millions of people are leaving their job as a consequence of both government and corporations failing to protect them and then having to protect their families. So I guess things like in the mix, the matrix of success here, the prescription for healing would be things like universal pre-K. Can you talk about that connection that you so eloquently alluded to about the other things that are part of a healthy country?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think it really helps to bring a kind of life course health perspective to this and to understand that if we really want to start turning things around in this country, we need to start attending to certainly children, youth, and families generally, and families and their ability to care for and provide for and protect both their children, aging parents, others, other dependents. We need a caregiving economy, and we need to allow the people that do this caregiving, certainly family members, but also all the others that really touch upon our family's lives in different ways, whether it's teachers and early childhood education workers and others. We need to be supporting them and building out those systems and providing them. But another big big piece of this, and again, this comes through in the data, are really the racialized outcomes that we're seeing on health and survival. And, you know, these health inequities that we are documenting, but, you know, let's be clear, we're all suffering, like even white privileged Americans are actually not faring as well as their counterparts in other countries. But the racialized patterns we're seeing are very large, very profound, and I think it's pretty clear that they are a reflection of, you know, decades, if not centuries, of systemic racism and ways that we are limiting opportunities and intentionally disadvantaging certain groups over others. And I think that really needs to be called out, and it needs to be woven into every aspect of our response.
Well, and of course, the Urban Institute has been leading the way on that for so long. We have some callers on the line. Caller, where are you calling from? What's your name? What's on your mind?
Hey, good morning. This is TK calling from the Bronx. I have, a comment and a question.
Sure.
The comment is, we all know they're constantly saying there's a shortfall in Social Security because they're constantly digging in it.
right.
Is there any doubt in anybody's mind that all of this has been thought of beforehand because they know a lot of black people, minorities, people of color, whatever category you want to put us in, we don't get that Social Security money too tough because we either die before we get it or we die 2 seconds after we start getting it. So I'm thinking that this is part of the plan. We're the most of that 900,000 dead. So, hey, if you could get 1 million of these minorities off the Social Security roll, that'll help with some of the money. That's my thought. The question is, what the hell can we do about it? Because I'm sick of being the little dog getting kicked. What can we do about it?
So I would say all right, thank you. One prescription I have is we have to flip the tax pyramid, because my entire adult life, the U.S. tax code has been about accumulating wealth and punishing working people. And I say this because in New York State alone, back in like 1913, a Republican governor imposed a 5 cents per $100 for a stock transaction tax that at the time the New York Times predicted would end the economy as we know it, why Wall Street would move to New Jersey. And of course, the gray lady had to admit they were wrong. And then in the 1980s, Democrats, sad to say, decided to refund that nickel back to Wall Street. And so since we've given tens of billions of dollars back, and I started as a Cub reporter, we were closing rural and urban hospitals. And this is the thing we have to do. We have to make work pay and make sure that those who have accumulated great wealth, including corporations, can't hide in the Cayman Islands. So what are your thoughts about this? I mean, it does seem we have to talk about a major shift in how we look at priorities. And that starts with the economy.
Absolutely. I think, you know, both of your comments are ringing all kinds of bells for me, but, first of all, the tax system is, a whole discussion unto itself. But I think we need to understand that so much of what we're experiencing in this country is occurring against a backdrop of, you know, very high levels of inequality in income and wealth, large and growing inequality in income and wealth. And certainly the tax system, which is, you know, all about collecting revenue from some people and redistributing it in certain ways. All kinds of policies are sort of embedded in that tax system in ways that are often not completely transparent and not completely, being openly debated in a healthy democracy. And so I definitely think that is an important piece of the puzzle. And, you know, as for your caller's comment about, you know, all these payments into the Social Security system that people who are dying early never benefit from, I mean, that's an incredibly important discussion. As it turns out, even survivors of many of these individuals who are experiencing these early deaths are having difficulty tapping into benefits that even existing policies and regulations say that they're entitled to. And let's understand that, you know, in addition to the deaths, we are in a mass disabling event with COVID. We are into a mass bereavement event. And there are all kinds of ripple effects that we are now awash in that are only going to further complicate and challenge our, you know, our social, economic, political well-being.
Well, one of the things that comes out from my work as the chief leader is just the number. Even now, we still don't have a sense of the number of essential workers that perished through their service during the pandemic. We know, thanks to the Guardian and Kaiser Health, as of April, they estimate some 4,000 healthcare workers died as a consequence of occupational exposure. I know that COVID occupational exposure is a leading cause of death for law enforcement across the country. We're not even, Lordy, we're not even keeping track of this. And so what I'm concerned about, having done years and years of reporting on the 9/11 World Trade Center disaster and thousands of people sickened by that, that we really are not aware, not thinking, we're in the middle of a worker compensation crisis on a scale that I don't even think they're talking about in Washington. I mean, do you think, is that trajectory, I mean, isn't that going to be an issue? I mean, we see 25% of folks, that's a conservative number, have some long-term consequence of varying severity from COVID. Don't we need to be concerned about this? Hello? I wonder, did we lose Lottie? Do we have a caller on the line? Hello?
Hello?
Hello, yes, caller, identify yourself. Where are you calling from? What's on your mind?
Yes, Mayat from the Grotto, if you will.
Of course.
Very interesting discussion, Bob, and appreciate you for opening up the phone lines early and not just saying you're doing that. First of all, everything that's being said, TK's comment and question would have us reflect on a spiritual malaise that's so pervasive throughout the lands that there's no institution, even our most beloved institutions, that are not untouched by it. And it's something that we really, really must start to deal with. The fact that you would have a pandemic, and over 100 years ago when that very, very infamous flu that they misnamed the Spanish flu, which started in the U.S., I believe, at Fort Dix, one of their military bases, and many nations brought in universal health care except the U.S. And with this pandemic, you would think that the people who want to mandate the genetic therapy that, of course, could not be for everyone because we are all different constitutionally, and some of us reach for nature. And when you look at the history of the medical system, you should do a report, Bob. You'd be excellent to do a report around the Flexner Report, Rockefeller, the role he played with a certain type of allopathic medicine that closed down 5 black medical schools where blacks could only go to a black medical school. And the fact that nature and alternative, which Canada used to have until they turned to the U.S., they had a wonderful large Asian population bringing Chinese herbology, acupressure, acupuncture, all types of nature's ways, and they look to the U.S. and shut it down. So there's a lot of discussion to be had, but it needs to get back to nature and having options and choices. And that's my comment this morning. Thank you for the program.
Thanks so much for calling in. And this, I think, I'm glad we have Lori back on the line. This question of the pharma complex in general. I mean, one of the problems that I think we had, the government had, was that the same pharma complex that was being lionized for delivering the vaccine was itself still dealing with the fallout from the opioid criminal crisis, where they cynically exploited properties of a drug and destroyed communities. Can you talk about this question about how much corporations have to do with our public health? And it is true that coming out of the, even here in the United States, coming out of the Spanish flu, there was a real awareness and about the nature of community health. That's when we saw school nurses originated. The idea that if we wanted to advance our children's health, that we would put school nurses in each school. And then all of a sudden, in my lifetime, Lottie, it became like a school nurse would serve several schools and drive by a school each day. Can you talk about this connection between underinvestment in common sense measures like school nursing, where we don't have a school nurse per school?
Yeah, so absolutely. I think, community health, public health, all of these, efforts to kind of really bring prevention and, well care and attend to so many of the common problems that young people and families typically have, to kind of settings where they are already, whether that's your local community health clinic or community health workers that are out in people's homes, or, as you mentioned, school settings. I mean, these are certainly things that other countries are doing, and they're building systems that are sustainable financially and that work and work well. And I certainly think that's an area where we can be doing a better job. And even on the behavioral health front, in terms of both mental health conditions and substance use and addiction conditions, I mean, these are where so many of the needs are. And yet, these are sort of the outliers within the healthcare system, and they certainly are not pieces of the healthcare service delivery landscape that are getting kind of prioritized and strengthened adequately. And as for, pharma, it was really difficult to kind of, be reading daily about the role of, certain actors within that sector and their, role in the opioid epidemic, which is still killing many, many people. Let's understand that. To then, switch gears and, praise them for these vaccines, which of course are wonderful and are needed and, should be available globally to more segments of humanity, shall we say.
Right.
And, let's also recognize the cost of insulin, and all kinds of the fact that Americans are being asked to pay so much more for the exact same medicines that are available to people in many of our peer countries is also just it's very difficult to kind of square. If we think of the healthcare system about producing health and well-being and survival, then a lot of these things that we're observing are not really making sense.
Well, I have to tell you, it was a lot of geography we covered, and thanks for being putting to work math and demography in such an incredible way. You have an open invitation. What are the coordinates? How can people support the work of their institute and follow your very important work?
We have a wonderful website where a lot of the work being done by my colleagues in the Health Policy Center and in other policy centers can go and look and see the work that's being done. I'm pretty active on Twitter, and I'm always happy to be sharing and learning alongside others in that space. And I also, there's a wonderful policy research program that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is involved in called Policies for Action, where they're really putting different policies under the lens to understand how, from a policy perspective, we can be advancing health, well-being, and equity across the nation.
Thank you so much, Lori Erin. Thank you.
Thank
Have
you.
Have a great
Bob.
Day.
The look of love is saying so much more than these words could ever say. And what my heart has heard, well, it takes my breath away. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arms around you. How long I have waited, waited just to love you. Now that I have found you, you've got the look of love. It's on your face, the look the time can't erase. Be mine tonight. Let this be just the start of so many nights like this. Let's take a lover's vow and then seal it with a kiss. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arms around you. How long I have waited, waited just to hold you. Now that I have found you, don't ever go.
I love you so. Valentine's Day. Gotta send one out to my wife, Debbie. Been with me. We've been through so much together. It's just that kind of day where you have to take time to express the things that you don't express, just that one day. So I want to throw the lines open. There's a lot going on right now in the civil service and in unions. There's some this. I was at a Uniform Fire Officers Association press conference on Friday, listening to Annie Ansborough lay out what's going to happen to, we think, a dozen firefighters, maybe 30. We still don't know in terms of the layoffs that are going to happen as a consequence of what was a really adversarial approach that Mayor de Blasio launched, my way or the highway approach to this. There was another way to go. We saw it done with United Airlines, right? We had Sarah Nelson on discussing this, the flight attendants union head from CWA-AFA, talking about working together and collaborating. And Mayor de Blasio decided to go another way, confrontational, playing the unions off against each other. The lines are open at 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. I guess the thing that we have to keep in mind, there are some things that are moving forward in a positive way. We did see that the Uber drivers and the Taxi Workers Alliance were able to see, I think, a 5.6% increase for Uber and Lyft drivers. That's something that happened at the municipal level. That's something that was something that we saw a growing consensus that at the local level, we can have an impact on labor conditions. And I think this is probably the ticket to the future. We saw how with Build Back Better, we really got jammed up, right? They can't even come together. You heard Lori Erin lay out just how devastating our current situation is, just how much in disrepair America's public health system was permitted to get for all these years. And I do think that there's a direct connection between the slide in public health and what happened to unions. And this is an important part of this program's mission to recall that we have seen a deterioration of working people's conditions that were directly connected to the things that happened when Ronald Reagan dismissed summarily, mass fired all the air traffic controllers who were standing up for safety for Americans and for workplace safety for themselves. They were fired en masse. And really, we saw a major diminution in the power of labor. So I understand we have a caller on the line. Go ahead, caller. Where are you calling from? What's on your mind? Hello, go ahead. You're on.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, caller. Yes, where are you calling from? What's your name?
All right, this is Brother David from Brooklyn, and I see a big takeaway message from this discussion. For me, throwing around the word loosely, democracy, is, I see, totally incorrect. We do not live in a democracy. We live in a plutocracy. We live in a country where the rich and powerful control, the corporations control. Things are not done for the benefit of the masses of people. So this idea of saying a lie long enough and people start believing it is terrible, because if we had a democracy, we would do the things that people need. And that's not why this country runs the way it does. It's run in favor of those who rule, the plutocrats and the corporations that run the country. Also, when someone is going to give a demonstration like today, they ought to give a couple days notice so some of us can make arrangements to come to the demonstration. Don't tell us at the last minute. So
right.
What I'm saying is that people have to understand the nature of the place they're living in and not be fooled into thinking that all of these things that benefit private entities, corporations principally, are part of a democracy. This is a place that exists for the benefit of those who rule, and those are the people at the top. And at all levels, people are disadvantaged. What's going on with veterans, where during the Bush administration, they took away the VA health benefits for hundreds of thousands of veterans. They cut that down. So to think that this idea of democracy is really true is, I see it as the biggest lie going, because this place was never, from the beginning, ever going to be a democracy by those slaveholders who started the country.
Oh, thank you so much for that, Senator. Please call again. Thanks so much. We do have on the line Dr. Mark Levitas with the physicians for, I guess, Universal Healthcare. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, all.
Great. I'm sorry we had a little trouble connecting. First, I understand you have this extensive background in medicine, and so you've been a practicing physician, and now you're part of this what could be called a national movement when it comes to physicians in support of Medicare for All. Could you talk about that?
Surely. Physicians for a National Health Program is a national organization with approximately 20,000 members. Its sole objective is to advocate for a universal single health care system. So, in fact, we support the Jayapal bill, which is the current bill being considered by the House of Representatives nationally. We have a local chapter. The local chapter, Physicians for National Health Program, NY Metro, also backs the Jayapal bill. But our primary focus in New York is to support our statewide-based single-payer health bill called New York Health. Our chapter here has many physicians, but also has great contributions from non-medical people that work with us. The chapter works in two domains, legislative and grassroots organization. Both obviously are critical in order to make progress. Over the years, the chapter has assisted in the writing of the bill with Assemblyman Gottfried. It's lobbied our state senators and assemblymen just a lot to try to push it. The chapter has reached out to physicians organizations, grassroots organizations, religious groups, community groups, and so forth. And right now, we're working on a project with social media, I'd like to say a word about.
Sure, go ahead.
Storytelling project. And we're trying to assemble a number of people's personal stories of problems and woes they've had with the healthcare system, and we'll ultimately stream them on video and all that. And if any of the listeners would love to contribute, we'd love to hear from you. You can get and tell your story at www.nyhcampaign.org/story. That's www.nyhcampaign.org/story.
And so I'm wondering here, as a physician, you must have seen so much suffering related to people having trouble with getting access to care, where because they don't have preventative care or don't have a primary physician, then they have to have extreme measures. If you can talk about this disconnect, where if we were able to make an investment, as a good doctor like yourself suggests, proactively, we could really actually save costs, right, Dr. Mark?
Single payer save costs? Yes, of course it will save costs. Because when you think about it, a tremendous amount of cost is taken up by administrative work that wouldn't exist if you had only one payer. And, you know, it's a big issue now in terms of people trying to push to limit drug prices and allow the government to, or the provider to negotiate with pharmaceutical industry. Yes, so there's many ways in which we would limit the cost.
Well, and I guess, you know, one of the things, too, I'm speaking with Dr. Mark Levitas, Physicians for a National Health Program, who spent, you know, as a proficient physician associated for University of Medicine and Dentistry in Newark, but has a connection into New York, of course. We started our program with the initial Gloria Brandman giving us an update about what is going on with retirees, civil servant retirees. I know you're very well aware of that. Is there a connection between the desire of the Municipal Labor Committee and the current administration to drive folks into this Medicare Advantage plan? Is there a connection between?
I'd like to talk about that little bit. I'd like to add to what was said earlier in the program. Medicare Advantage, understand, is a misnomer. It's neither Medicare nor is it advantageous. If you choose a Medicare Advantage plan, such as Joe Namath wants you to, essentially Medicare gives a lump sum of money to your private insurance to administer your care. So, in fact, you no longer have Medicare. You have private insurance. And the term advantages is off also, because the advantages are really bribes. The free gym membership, free gym shoes, health care visits, these are nothing. But in fact, once you've taken that, now you have private insurance. And for private insurance, the less money spent on health care, the more money goes into profit. Can I tell you a story about a patient?
Well, we've got a minute. Is it a short story?
I guess so. But this is what our retirees can expect. This lady is 72 years old. She's a retired seamstress. So she lives on a pension. She makes a little pocket money doing piecework, but she has bad rheumatoid arthritis. She survives well because she gets monthly injections of steroids into her knuckles and does well. Her cost out of pocket for those until recently was $50. Recently, her carrier policy made the same change from Medicare to Medicare Advantage that the mayor is proposing for our retirees. The first time she went to the hospital after that change, the bill was no longer $50. It was $1,040. And so that's what we have to look forward to. And the link that you're asking for is, we need Medicare for all.
Oh, that was really something. What are the coordinates if people want to get involved with what you guys are doing?
How do you get involved?
Yeah, how do people get in touch with you and your group?
Oh, I do want to talk to that. We're a very active group. We're outgoing. We're looking for people. In fact, we have a monthly forum, and the forum actually will be held tomorrow night, Tuesday evening, on Zoom, so you don't have to leave your house to go. And the topic is going to be privatization of medical care. So we're going to talk about this a little bit tomorrow evening. We'd love to have all of your listeners join.
We've got to wrap it up. We'll make sure to tweet all this out. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Mark Levis. And so have a great Valentine's Day. Take some care with the people that you love. Stay tuned tomorrow in this time for Frenchie Davis, and Democracy Now! Is up next.
Is here to stay, not for a year, but ever and a day. The radio and the telephone and the movies that we know may just be passing fancies, and in time they go.
Fitzgerald, Love Is Here to Stay. Thank you so much, Bob Henley, for that piece of music. Wonderful to start off our day. This is listener-supported, commercial-free radio station, WBAI, in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many people love giving flowers on Valentine's Day, but a dozen roses may not be the most climate-friendly way to say, I love you. Lisa Larson is a flower grower and florist in Mount Horeb, Wisconsin.
Most flowers are imported from overseas or from South America, and they're dry-packed in a box without water. So they make this really long journey.
That trip generates a lot of carbon pollution. Buying locally grown flowers may seem like a better alternative, but in most parts of the country, growing flowers in the winter requires heated greenhouses, which often use energy from fossil fuels. But Larson says there are climate-friendly ways to enjoy flowers on Valentine's Day.
I'm a big proponent of dried flowers, and so that is what I've always done in the winter, because that is what's available and that is the most sustainable option.
When local flowers are not in season, she makes wreaths with flowers that were grown and dried in summer, such as globe amaranth, yarrow, and larkspur. She says another option is flowers grown from cold, hardy bulbs.
People just have to kind of change their mindset of what they're used to seeing if they want to be green on Valentine's Day.
But with a little creativity, you can use flowers to say, I love you, and I love the earth. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Currently, it's 18 degrees here in New York City, going up to a high today of only 29 degrees. It is cold outside. Thank you so much for tuning in to listener-sponsored, commercial-free radio WBAI at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Thanks to all of our callers and our guests and the programming that you support and have supported for 62 years. Some of you have been a listener sponsor for 4 decades or more, and we thank you so much. Those of you who are new to WBAI, new